Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed. Welcome to Passy Muir's CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aerodigestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Brooke Richardson, having a conversation on considerations for competency.
So I want to welcome back a repeat podcaster with me. I have with me today Brooke Richardson, a speech-language pathologist from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I had Brooke come back because she and I tend to get on a soapbox and a hot topic box talking about competencies and practicing at the top of our license and the skills that we need to work in acute care. And so I thought it would be another time we could chat about that, Brooke. So I want to welcome you again.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and to get on another soapbox with you.
Thanks for joining me. I'll start us out talking about in our practice. One of the things that comes up a lot and with what I do is people asking, you know, can I suction patients? Can I inflate and deflate cuffs? You know, that type of thing when they're working with patients with tracheostomies. And I always share that it's within our scope of practice from an ASHA standpoint. Mm-hmm. However, it is state and facility dependent. And just mm-hmm. because you do it in one facility doesn't mean that you can take that skill and use it in another facility. So I okay. thought maybe we could start talking about the competencies needed for your job and then, you know, how, what does carry over, what does not carry over, and kind of how we can use our skills.
Yeah. Yeah. So I can say that I've worked full-time in 3 hospitals, PRN in an additional hospital on both coasts of the United States. So I've worked in a couple of different regions. No matter which medical center I've worked in, I've gotten varying degrees of training and supervision and checkoffs. So where I completed my clinical fellowship, I got signed off really quickly on, probably too quickly for young little CF Brooke, on clinical swallow evals and speaking valves and inline valves and pretty much everything. And then after I had about 3 years of experience, I moved across the country to North Carolina and worked at a large academic medical center. And boy, was the process different there. Not saying good or bad, just totally different. So I walked in expecting with 3 years of experience under my belt to, you know, be able to just go and do a clinical swallow eval on any unit in the hospital. And that was not the case. I had to go through a really rigorous sign-off process that involved seeing all sorts of different patient populations. So the same patient populations I worked with in California, lung transplant, heart transplant, neuro, gen med, everything. But the way that this medical center wanted things done was very different than the first medical center I had worked at. And they did things differently anyway. So I had to, of course, follow their protocols, their policies and procedures, their documentation standards. I mean, everything is different. So it was the same job, right? The same career title, but doing things in a very different way. So I may not have been deemed competent there, even though I was deemed competent at the other hospital I worked at.
You know, it's funny. I had the exact same experience at 2 large teaching hospitals. And at the first one, I had very extensive training. I was not signed off quickly in my CF. It was very extensive, very detailed competency training. And they did separate competencies for trach and vent. For modifieds and trach and vent, we had very specific. And then we had one for adult and we had one for peds. So that if you were going to see both patient populations, you had to get certain training and sign off. And when I left that hospital after almost 8 years, I went to another large level 1 trauma center teaching hospital in North Carolina and basically started over with the competencies. Mm-hmm. Even though I had almost 8 years of experience and had mm-hmm. been, extensively trained, they had their own policies and procedures, like you said, their own processes. And I started over getting checked off on everything. That is a good starting point, I think, because we both talked about competencies in the facility. And I want to ask your opinion on something, because competency to me is a word, I don't know if we misuse it. I don't know if it's misinterpreted. I'm not sure if it's overused. I'm not sure what it is, but you know, what makes someone competent? And I say that because when we finish grad school, they sign off and say we're competent. We have our competencies in certain areas, but then we go to work and we have to do more competencies. Mm-hmm. And then we're talking about, we changed hospitals and we had to do more competencies. So what is competent? Like, when do we become competent? What is that? Let's talk about that word a little bit.
This is such a philosophical conversation and I love it. I love all the philosophical med SLP stuff. I could talk to you about this all day, but I think it's interesting that our CCC has the word competence. That is one of the C's, Certificate of Clinical Competence. I think that competence is more than a double-edged sword. I think that competence is, we might have a basic competence for passing the praxis, right? And that allows us to get our C's from ASHA, which allows us to practice essentially, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we are practicing competently. So to me, practicing competently is asking a lot of questions all of the time, really being committed to lifelong, career-long learning, and competently acknowledging that we are never going to know it all. You could have the most brilliant expert, clinician, researcher, what have you, who knows a lot, but they don't know it all. And I think that sometimes the word competence could be interpreted, which I think is misinterpreted, is meaning ready to go out and see any patient just because you have your C's or because you were deemed competent in a swallow evaluation and go in like a bull in a china shop and just bust through those doors and see that patient and everything's going to be fine. When in reality, every patient that we see is new. No two patients are exactly the same from many, many perspectives, from medical perspectives, from cultural perspectives. We need to really acknowledge that we need to go into that room and ask questions and understand that individual patient, including their medical history. And I think competence is really more about asking questions and professional growth and development and being open to feedback and seeking feedback and not thinking that we're perfect. What do you think?
Oh, I agree completely. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that, well, it was a couple of pieces of what you said, but talking about we have to be able to ask questions and that we're continuing to learn. As you had said, there's no way to know it all. Nobody knows it all. And we have to be able to ask the right questions and we have to be able to know what we know and don't know. I actually think our competency is being able to admit what we know and don't know and then seeking the information that we need to round it out. And the fact that, like you said, no two patients are the same. You can think that you know something really well and you can get hit by a curveball all the time because somebody has a little bit different diagnosis or different symptoms or has a comorbidity that wasn't there with the other patients you had seen that now tweaks it all a little bit. And so being, you know, we're constantly learning.
Right. And I want to go back to something you said about knowing what you don't know. I think that's possible in some situations, but I think sometimes people, because we're human, can have blind spots that we're not aware of. And we need to listen to people who tell us that we have a blind spot, because we might not know that what we're doing is harmful or not evidence-based or not even theory-based, right? That it's not sound. We need to not let our egos get in the way of our patients.
Oh, that's a big one. Yeah. Especially when we're working in, well, any setting. I started to say, especially when we're working in acute care. The only reason I was going to say that is because we're working with medically complex patients where some of our decisions could make a difference in their recovery or even in life and death with some things. Mm-hmm. And so it has a more critical aspect to it than some other settings may have, but it's true across the board for all settings.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Because there's also potential harm you could do to the patient, right? You might have a patient who can't afford the gas to get to therapy in an outpatient setting, but they come. And then if you're wasting visits, I use that term with air quotes, but you know, if you're wasting visits because you're not asking a question of another colleague, whether someone you trust at work or a mentor you have elsewhere, or you're providing therapy that is not backed by evidence or sound theory, and you're just continuing to see this patient over and over again, you're doing harm to that patient with their time, with their finances. So there are lots of levels of harm, I guess, depending on what setting we're in.
No, completely. With the people listening, they're going to be going, well, but how do I get that competency? So let's talk a little bit about, since we're telling people that there are just different levels of knowledge and experience, and depending on the setting, and then as we mentioned, if you change settings, you know, what your skill sets are in can be very different. So what are some things people can do to establish themselves and feel like they do have a good foot in the door? They have a good understanding of the setting they're working in. What would be your number one pick? Like if you say you had never done fees and you wanted to start doing it, like what would be your first step?
I think it depends on if your facility already has a fees program in place, for example, and if they're willing to do one. So I think having a continuing education foundational knowledge is important for anything that we're doing, but I'm not going to invest in something like a fees class if my facility is truly never, ever, ever going to offer fees, you know, if they'd rather like outsource it to a mobile fees company or something, for example. So I think it's very beneficial to take continuing education that is directly pertinent to who we're seeing currently, who we might want to see. Like if somebody wants to change from, I don't know, skilled nursing to acute care, getting acute care specific education is really, really important. But then how do you bridge that education into some sort of clinical experience when, you know, we always say that people who need to get a job need to have experience first. So I think probably getting some sort of foundational knowledge, but making sure that it's pertinent. And then finding a mentor to help you figure out how to maybe parlay that into some sort of approach toward competence with patient care.
I think you brought up a good point with the continuing education. So we all have that requirement. We have to maintain, we have to have that continuing education to maintain our certification, our C's, state licensure. Each state has slightly different requirements. Some require a few more hours, some a few less, or they have certain topic areas, like your number of ethics hours may be different, you know, that type of thing. But you said a really key point with continuing education is to try to get that continuing education in your area of practice. Or if you're thinking of changing your setting, like say you're in the schools and you want to transition into a medical setting or vice versa, medical to schools, you might take continuing education that starts to prepare you for that new setting. That may be a reason to take it kind of outside of your current work area. I did air quotes too when I said outside of your current work area, but the majority of your continuing education really needs to be pertinent to your clinical practice and what you're doing with patients. That's the biggest, that's probably a primary means to expanding your skill set and just getting the competency you need for the area that you're working in. I've seen some people have different goals with their education. Unfortunately, some who say, well, I only want to take things that are free. I hate to bring that up, but free is not necessarily always better, or it can be great education, but it may not be, it needs to be pertinent to what you're doing.
Yep, exactly. Maybe you take all of the continuing education that is pertinent to your area of practice, and then you go above and beyond and you take additional education just because you're intellectually curious. That's fine. But I'm a strong believer that we really need to focus on things that are pertinent to us. And sometimes we don't even know what's pertinent to us. Like for me, I had no idea how body systems had such an important role in what I do with my patients every single day until I'd seen this pattern repeated over and over that COPD and GERD were in my patients' charts together all of the time. And then I looked it up and I went down this rabbit hole and I learned how they interacted and then how that's going to affect what I'm going to do with these patients from now on. And so there has to be a certain degree of curiosity and listening too to the people who are curious and wanting to push and really expand our knowledge base is really important. But I agree, you know, free isn't always best. Also, we don't need to spend $1,000, $2,000, whatever. Spending that much money also doesn't guarantee that something is going to be pertinent or you're going to get a job in XYZ setting. We need to be mindful of budget. I get that. I'm also on a budget. But really critically appraising, is this really going to help me? And is this worth the investment or should I pay more than just free?
You just made what I said better. because I just kind of stuck on the free. The point was that the cost of it should not be the deciding factor. Mm-hmm. It's really the quality of the education. And so you've really got to look at what you're getting in that education, whether it's free or whether it costs a lot of money or it's somewhere in the middle. You really want to know the quality. And how do you assess the quality of the education? Well, it's hard sometimes to really know. We can't just go by reviews that people give. We have to be discerning on, you know, the speaker's qualifications, the experience that's brought to the table for what's taught. Is it something that person's, you know, got some years of experience in? Right. What type of research and evidence base are they bringing to that education? You know, is it solely like what they've done an opinion, or is it based on the evidence? And they brought in that support, the research support for what they're teaching, and they're able to present. You mentioned at the beginning, oh, we can get so philosophical. And a lot of what we do is, and can they bring in the theory and the research and the clinical experience and give a broad perspective?
Right.
That's one thing I would say. What would you add to that?
Yeah, I agree. And I want to go back to your point on how much experience a person has. I have a couple philosophical points there too. One is if a speaker or company is not transparent about how much experience that speaker has, we need to demand that as consumers of education, because we need to know, is this person really an expert? Is this person coming to me with 20 years of experience where they have committed to lifelong learning and they've changed their practice over the years and they're sharing what they think to be best practice or a knowledge base now, but they would give a different talk in 5 years because they continue to grow and improve? Or is this somebody with 1 year of experience who is teaching me? Is this somebody with 20 years of experience in the schools and then is self-taught in medical and has been working in medical for 1 year? It's really important that we demand sort of that transparency in who our speakers are and why we should listen to them. You know, sometimes people have a really good different perspective on something who have less years of experience than us. Sometimes it's more years of experience than us, but we need to be able to make that informed decision, just like we expect our patients. Hopefully we all expect that for our patients to make an informed decision.
You reminded me of something, and it's shifting back slightly to the competency, because that was something when we were developing our fees program, that was a big question. Like, when do you sign someone off? Mm-hmm. And how do, you know, how much experience do they need before they become competent? And it was a huge question mark. And it was a big discussion, even at a conference that I went to, because was it time-based or the number of patients based? Like, did you say, well, you have to do this for 3 months? Or do you have to see 20 patients? And there was this big discussion because you could do something for a year and only see 5 patients. Mm-hmm. And you could do it for a month and see 50 patients, depending on your setting and where you work. And so the year's experience aren't necessarily the answer either. You know, like you have to have, there's a lot of pieces to that puzzle as to if someone's competent or has the experience, because you could have someone who has fewer years, but has a great amount of experience because of the setting they're in. And they've seen just a ton of patients and they've, you know, done a whole lot. And then you could have someone who's got a lot of years and doesn't have as much experience. And then you could have a combination with a lot of years and a lot of experience.
Right.
So you've really got to look at all those pieces that you mentioned. It's not just years. It's not just setting or patient experience, but
yeah. Yeah. So. And how do we show this, right? Because continuing education is a business, just like, you know, selling, I don't know, workbooks is a business. And some people are going to be very willing to be transparent and give, you know, a ton of detail so that people can make a decision on whether a course is right for them. The last thing that I want when someone signs up for my course is for them to not understand what the course is about and to think that they're going to get something out of it that I never, ever intended as part of a learning outcome or something like that. But we as consumers need to hold our own selves accountable for being informed when we're taking a course or buying a resource or something like that, that we're doing more research rather than just clicking the buy now button.
Well, and you used a key word, accountability. I mean, that's true kind of all the way around. The speakers are accountable, the providers are accountable, the facilities are accountable, but we as individuals really have to take, we have some autonomy in this. As speech language pathologists, we're an autonomous profession, and we have to take a lead role in that and responsibility for that accountability, you know, checking things and not assuming something's good just because it's there, but, you know, really discerning that the information is good and the speaker's qualified, you know, and all of those parameters, you know, just kind of checking. We want to make sure we're getting, you know, good education.
Yeah. And bringing it back to actual competency when we're working is there are some people who will say to their employer, okay, I'll use myself for an example. I haven't changed a TEP in 12 years, maybe. It's been a long time, okay? If we have a physician who consults us on a laryngectomy, I'm in acute care right now, and they think the patient is aspirating, I can do the best that I can with the knowledge that I have to look and see if a patient is aspirating by doing like leak test or doing a modified barium swallow, which is a whole other situation sometimes with these patients. Because my hospital just doesn't do laryngectomies. We get them admitted sometimes with respiratory failure, and then I'm going, ah! So me telling my physicians, hey, I have not changed a TEP in years. We do not have the education for that. We do not have the clinical support. We do not have ENTs who do that. We do not have the prostheses. We don't have those things here. And going to your management, right? And saying, we're being asked to do this. I'm not competent. None of us is, whatever. If no one on your team is competent and you're not competent, and really acknowledging that and owning that, it's okay. I can't stay up to date on best practice and everything that's in our scope of practice. I cannot do it. And I don't believe anybody can, philosophically. Again, I've heard stories of people going and saying, hey, I haven't changed a TEP in 12 years. I'm not competent. And their management or whoever goes, well, figure it out. And sometimes we do get pushback. We get pushback if we're asking to buy RMT devices. We get pushback if we're asking for tongue depressors. And we get pushback for continuing education if it doesn't involve X, Y, Z. And then we get pushback if we say, okay, you're not paying to send me to a continuing education course on this. Now we have one of these patients. I'm not competent. We really need to continue to hold ourselves accountable and just say, sure, it's in our scope of practice, absolutely, but I am not competent in that. Full stop, refer the patient out elsewhere. I'm not seeing a patient that I'm not competent in seeing.
Well, and another point to that, talking about the accountability aspect of it, and it's a very difficult line when your boss is saying, do this, but it's putting your license on the line and your certification, because you could, if you did harm and if someone by chance reported it and you were not competent in that area, that is a violation for your C's. It's a violation for your state license. And you could potentially be brought up on charges and lose your license and lose your certification. And your excuse cannot be, my boss made me do it.
Exactly.
That's not going to get you out of the trouble. So even though that can be really hard and people are like, well, I'd lose my job. Well, I've seen people respond to that sometimes and say, well, maybe you should lose your job, like change jobs. I don't mean, none of us want to get fired. I don't mean that, but, and it's very hard to find jobs and it's very hard to change jobs. And I realize that, but we've got to set our boundaries, because ultimately it's our license, it's our certification, it's our reputation, it's our skills as a clinician that we're putting on the line, even though our boss is making you do it. It's just like ignorance of the law is no excuse, they say, in the legal realm. You can't say, well, I didn't know. And they say, oh, well, then we'll forgive you for breaking whatever law it was you broke. You know, that doesn't work. And it's the same thing in our field. It doesn't work to say, but I did. Actually, it's really bad to say, well, I didn't know, because then you're, you know, admitting, you know, you didn't have the competencies. But you don't want to practice where you're not competent, because it can harm. Number one, it could harm the patient. And do more harm than good, or really impact their recovery, or some situations could even lead to death if something's not done properly. There are, there are things that we do that could contribute to and or cause death if we're not doing them appropriately. And so we've got to be really aware of our skills.
Right. I mean, similar concept is doing something just because the doctor ordered it. I mean, I can't tell you how many laryngectomies, I'm not picking on laryngectomies, but how many laryngectomies I've been consulted on for a speaking valve. And if I didn't do my due diligence as a clinician and go through the chart and go, they have a history of vocal cord cancer. And there's not much, you know, not much history in the chart. And I go, history of vocal cord cancer, chronic trach, totally possible. There are people who have chronic trachs because they had, you know, a hemilaryngectomy or something like that, or they had vocal cord cancer and their cords are paralyzed from treatment or from nerve damage. So there are patients where maybe that consult could be appropriate. But if I didn't do my due diligence, look at that patient's history with a fine tooth comb and then go and feel on their neck to see if there might be a larynx in there. And also, of course, if they don't have a trach or a lary tube in place, look for a TEP. Obviously not all laryngectomies have TEPs, but I could kill somebody.
I'm going to add to that an experience I had personally as a clinician. I had a patient, had had a trauma, had had a tracheal dissection, was riding a motorcycle and went through a clothing line and had just cut right through his, well, actually part of his larynx and trachea. And I saw all of this in the chart, and they had ordered a speaking valve. The patient had a trach, but I kept, you know, I was doing a very thorough chart review, which is a part of what we have to do, you know, because that's the only way we get the information we need. And they had in the chart that the patient had a stent, a laryngeal stent. And I, at the time, I was like, I don't know what this is. I mean, I did, generally speaking, but I didn't know the specifics. It just said a laryngeal stent. And there are different types of stents. And I went to the doctor and he said, oh, no, you can use a valve. He said, it's a laryngeal stent to help hold his larynx open. And he goes, we want him talking, blah, blah, blah. And he's going on and on. And I kept probing and I kept asking questions because it didn't sit well with me. And some stents can be a ring or they can be a tube and they're hollow so you can have space through. But I kept probing the doctors, asking questions. And it finally came out that it was a solid disc stent. And I looked at the doctor and I said, so how's he going to exhale, you know, out his mouth and nose? And he goes, what do you mean? And I explained how the valve worked because he didn't actually know. He knew people talked with it, but he didn't know that he had to be able to exhale out his mouth and nose. And then when I explained all that, he was like, oh no, he can't use it. We can't have any pressure there. It's like, it would blow the stent out. And I was like, oh, I'm glad I just bombarded you with a lot of questions and, you know, did this because it could have gone really bad. We have to be able, this kind of takes us full circle back to the beginning. We have to be willing to ask questions and ask the right questions, you know, and make sure we have that full history on the patient. And if we don't have the history, we maybe it's a stop point. We have to wait until we can get that information, depending on the setting and the patient and, you know, all that's going on with them, because it could really, you know, we have to know what we're dealing with.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think your story is a really good reminder of the importance of collaboration and just knowing that you need to ask more questions. It's not safe and it is not competent, I think, to just go flying into a room, seeing a patient after seeing that they're admitted for, I don't know, a stroke and not knowing that their back history is COPD, laryngeal cancer. Why am I going with laryngeal cancer today? It's like on my mind. Myasthenia gravis, post polio syndrome. It's not appropriate to just go in and not have those really good thorough chart reviews, which is 90% of the importance of what I do in acute care. That conversation with the physician, like you said, this doesn't sound quite right. You know, help me think this through, because they don't know everything either. we don't know everything and they don't know everything, but together, if we can have these conversations, and easier said than done with some coworkers, I know not everybody's open to discussion, but we still need to try. We can become competent in that way too, is from learning from other professionals.
Just a real quick example on that same why you ask questions. And one of the, we're really investigators. Mm-hmm. Speech language pathologists, one of the things I say about speech language pathologists, and I've said this my whole career, is that we're a little different than most professions because we have an ability to communicate, and we are also, we have a little more time. And I don't mean we have more time in our day or anything, but we have a little more flexibility in how we manage our time. Mm-hmm. And it allows us to take another second to ask one more question or to read one more thing in the chart, you know, to try. We are investigators and we pull all these pieces together. And sometimes we're the only person that sees the issue. Yes. Because we have the time to ask and talk to the different team members and to pull those pieces in. And we kind of get that ball rolling to make a more cohesive approach to what's going on. And so sometimes we're actually the ones identifying, especially when it comes to neuro disease processes and, you know, different things, because we see different aspects of it. And we tend to be that problem solvers, you know, and kind of pulling it in. But to do that, we have to ask mm-hmm. the right questions. We have to have competencies and training, you know, in what we're working in and be able to pull it together.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in one of my classes, I call us dysphagia detectives. It was very specific to dysphagia, obviously. But we're detectives. We're pulling all of these pieces of a puzzle together. And it's not only that we have the, like you said, the capability of doing it, but we have the responsibility of doing it. We really need to understand how important we can be for some of these patients. We can discover strokes and cancer in individuals. And we need to really, of course, have that foundational knowledge, once again, of neuroanatomy and of normal swallowing physiology, of normal language and cognition and speech. We need to have that foundational knowledge, but we need to be able to apply that into practice.
Well, I used to tell my students that all the time. You have to know the normal to identify the abnormal or atypical. So having that foundational knowledge across the board is critical. And we started out talking about competencies and we shifted slightly, but all of it is linked to competency. And the idea that, to summarize kind of what we were talking about, is we need to be competent in what we practice. We can have a broad-based competencies, but we're not experts in everything. Mm-hmm. And we have to seek that additional information, which may be a big piece of it is continuing education. You mentioned having a mentor, having someone, if you've got someone in your facility or in a facility where you can maybe go and observe, but getting that experience or exposure to what you're looking at. And then another big piece was not being afraid to ask questions and not being afraid to admit what you don't know, mm-hmm. because it's really critical that we self-evaluate and know our strengths and weaknesses and then seek to fill in those weak gaps, you know, to seek the education, seek the mentors, ask the questions. And sometimes we're the ones that are solving the puzzle, or at least bringing enough pieces to it that the team solves the puzzle. I'm not right. trying to say we do it all. I'm just saying that we tend to be inquisitive and we tend to ask questions and we can help to pull all those pieces together.
Right.
Do you have any summary points you'd like to add?
Well, I think you summarized it really well, but here's a question I want to leave us with is, if you had to sign every note that you write, eval, treatment, whatever, with, I certify that I am competent in managing the care of this patient and that I did not allow my ego to get in the way of caring for this patient, could we all do that? Because really, when we're signing a note, that's what we're doing. And I think we need to remember that in America, CCC SLP means that you are competent. I want people to think about that. If you had to sign that on every note you wrote, that you are competent in taking care of that patient or that kind of patient, could you do it?
Oh, that is a good question to end on. Thank you, Brooke, again, for joining me and talking about competencies and some of the things we can do to help make sure that we're practicing at the top of our license. We'll have you again, I'm sure.
I'm sure. There's a lot to talk about.
That too.
Thank you.